Okay, so the theme of the gods. If we deal with the context of this quickly first, this shouldn't be too new to you. The idea of examining and thinking about the relationship between people and God, or the gods, is particularly relevant in the Renaissance period. As we said before, it was a time of great questioning, and it was a time of questioning everything. Scientific discoveries, looking back to ancient civilizations, the Greeks and the Romans in particular, caused thinkers, philosophers, writers, scientists to question a lot of the received wisdom, that the understanding that was prevalent at the time. The church, anybody who's done history will know this, the church was the power, both in terms of establishing order, but also in terms of informing thinking. And the church's teaching on God was, of course, well known, and would have been well known and understood and believed by the vast majority of the population. It's difficult to put ourselves back into that place now, where people have a variety of views about God. The prevailing view is probably cynicism. But you put yourself back there, and the prevailing view was an absolute, unwavering belief in the existence of God and in the character of God as taught by the church.
Do you know when you say £400?
Yeah.
Does that include the VAT? Because we don't pay for VAT. Can you find out?
I'm not sure. Yeah, Debbie took the quote.
Oh, shall I think?
Yeah, it's Debbie. Yeah.
So to put it really simply, you know this, and those of you who know your history or your RE will know that I'm simplifying this horribly, but the prevailing view of God was that God was interested in human affairs, and that he had very... there was real certainty about the way God wanted society organised and the way that he wanted people within society to behave. So we have things like the Great Change, we know about that. And we know, of course, about the basic Christian beliefs. You don't lie, you tell the truth. If you do something that's wrong, the seven deadly sins were often seen as the list of those things that you could do wrong. Then if you ask forgiveness and you genuinely repent, then God will forgive. And your eternal destiny, if you like, was very important. Again, it's difficult for us to kind of grasp that in its entirety, but lifespans are much shorter. To live to 50 for the average man or woman was a really good innings. You've done well. But then, context I'm
40. But you know, the people around the school, the older generation of teachers, often refer to me as young man. When you see a bit more, you'll be a bit more experienced. But you know, back in that time, actually, I would have been the older generation, and I would be the wise, the older generation, passing down their wisdom to the young. Wait, there's something else. Oh no, I don't actually need that. Thank you. Put it on my desk there, which is excellent. Okay, so where are we? I'm off the track here.
Lifespan's 50 years old.
Yeah, lifespan. So your eternal destination was important to you because it was near. And how you spend the rest of your life. And the basic teaching, as taught by the morality plays of the time, talked about those last time, and told by the teaching of the church, is that if you do good, if you behave well, if you follow the church's instruction, you keep your place in society and you follow your duty, then you will spend eternity in heaven. And if you do step off the path of goodness, righteousness, if you forgive, if you repent rather, God will forgive you. He's a gracious God, and you will be you will spend eternity in heaven, although you might need to spend some time in purgatory on the way through. Horribly, horribly simplified, but that's kind of where it is. So we come to King Lear in the with that context understood. And there's two things immediately to say about King Lear. King Lear is set in a pagan time. And so rather than talking about God, as in the Christian God, we talk about the gods, the pagan gods, derived from the Greek and Roman gods. That allowed Shakespeare to do a number of things. It was a legitimate thing to do because the original story of King Lear wasn't Shakespeare's story originally, of course. He borrowed it from tradition and myth and made it his own story. But that original story is set back in pagan time, so he was very legitimate to do that. But what it allowed Shakespeare to do is to examine gods and the role of the gods and the character of the gods without directly criticising or making comment on the Christian God. And that allowed him to skip past censorship. And it allowed him to avoid the wrath of the church, because you'll know, I'm sure, stories, Galileo, famous one, some years after Shakespeare, not many, who was imprisoned and faced execution because he was seen to be a heretic. He was seen to be teaching against the teachings of the church. So it was important for Shakespeare that he could distance himself a bit from that. And what this play allows him to do is to explore and examine the role of the gods whilst not directly exploring and examining the role of the Christian God. However, it seems clear to me, and it seems that most critics would agree with me in this, that the play is an exploration of the relationship between God and man. Not simply an exploration of pagan gods, but of God, the God of the Christian church. Critics fall into two camps on this one. There are a minority of critics who come at this from a Christian perspective. They read the text from a Christian perspective. Much like when we looked at Handmaid's Tale, we looked at it from a feminist perspective. They explore this text from a Christian perspective. And they would argue that the text, the play, does uphold the Christian belief system and does uphold the character of the Christian God. We'll look at why in a minute, at least we can say that. And then there are other critics, and we'll look at some of these by name in the lesson too, but there are other critics who would say, no, what this play does actually is it cuts at the very heart of the Christian teaching about God. and it asks big questions about God's existence and God's character. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just suggest to you a Christian reading of the play, and then we'll have a discussion about that, and you can tell me where that is upheld, where you can see that actually supported by the text, and where you think, hang on a minute, that doesn't quite make sense. Alright, so the Christian reading of King Lear would say, God has established his order, the great chain of being. God has established his commands about goodness and how to behave properly. And what we see in this play is what happens when people go against those rules and those commands. So we see what happens when King Lear doesn't live up to his duty and his responsibility as God's king. And we see what happens when his daughters behave so horribly to their father. Barbarously. We see what happens when people try and connive and manipulate their way to pecking. And they would say that what the play says very clearly is if you go against God's commands, then chaos erupts. Which is why it's really important to listen to what God says and to stay in his will. They would also say that by the end of the play, although the ending is harsh and bleak, we see a restoration of things back to how they should be. And although King Lear dies, he dies having been reconciled to his daughter Cordelia. For a brief moment, I mean, you may not have caught it when we watched it, but for a brief moment, King Lear is given back kingship of the kingdom. Albany gives it back to him. He has it for about 30 seconds before he dies, but he has it back. So there is a sense of everything being restored back to how it should be, and that happens because King Lear realises his mistake, he repents of it, realises his mistake, he asks Cordelia's forgiveness, and things are kind of restored back to how they should be. So it's a warning, it's a story of warning. What happens when you go against God's commands, but it shows us that God is good and in the end will restore things back to how they should be. And the two men who are the only two men left standing at the end of the play, Edgar and Albany, are two men who have done good and done right to the play. And therefore they stand to continue the kingdom and the kingship in the good direction. And lastly, they would say, therefore, although it's bleak, it is a play about hope. Because it's a play that says, however chaotic things can become, if you step away from God's will, God will restore things back to his shape and to his order. Although there will be a price to pay for that. Okay, so that is the Christian Orthodox reading of the play. And that's the reading of the play that would have got it past the censors and would have avoided Shakespeare's head on a plate. So, we'll open it up. What supports that reading of the play? What supports that idea? And is there anything in the play that you think, well, hang on a minute, that doesn't quite sit right? Go on.
Shakespeare tell, like, suggests how to read it, or do you just
let people interpret it.
He would have let people interpret it. Don't forget, this is a play that was performed in front of the king, King James. So we need to be very careful about what he was saying. With King James, of course, would have been his court and important men in the church. But yes, he would have let it be interpreted. So, go on.
I missed the last bit of the play, but what happened to the two sisters? Did anything happen?
Yeah, they did, both died. I forgot to go over the story of the play, didn't I? I'll do that at the beginning of the next lesson. So would you agree with that reading of the play? Does that sound, does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. No. If you look at it, everyone that tried to move out of their position basically ended up dead.
Yes.
Back in their own position, good. So to speak.
Good, really, really good point. Everybody who tried to move out of their position ended up dead. It's fair. Fair point. Anybody else agree? Well, lots of people said yes. Well, why do we agree with that? Would you agree? Okay, let's come at this as a different question. Would you agree that by the end of it, it's a play that, however bleak, suggests hope? What's going on, Lauren?
I'm not really sure about that.
Okay, why?
Everyone's dead, and like, what's hopeful about that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, King Lear ends with a stage of dead people. That's the truth. And they're all laid out on stage, visible to us as an audience. So yes, what's hopeful about that? It's a good question.
I can't remember his name, but isn't there one character whose intentions remain pure through the entire thing, and he's like a humble servant to the king, and he actually survives to the end?
Kent?
Might be Kent, I can't remember.
Kent is loyal to the king throughout. Gets banished by the king, comes back as a servant and serves him as best he can, and in the end finally reveals who he is. Kent's last words of the play, he's asked to stay and help lead the new kingdom forward, the new leadership, and he refuses, and he says, "My master calls, I'm going to join my master." His master is King Lear, and King Lear is dead. The suggestion is that Kent is going to go and join him there. So although we don't see Kent dead at the end, the suggestion is that he will be soon. When you got to the end, those of you here, and you saw the end of it, did it feel like a hopeful end to the play? Or did it feel like, oh my word, this is about as bleak as it gets? What do you think an audience comes away out feeling from that? Hopeful? Oh, that was good. I've seen the play lots of times. I've seen some brilliant productions of it. I've seen some more right productions of it. But I can honestly say I never... What's the word? It's not that I haven't enjoyed it. I've been engrossed by it and engaged by it and thought about it a lot, but I never come out thinking, oh, wouldn't mind seeing that again. You kind of come out thinking, oh, my word. And that kind of, you come out into the light blinking a bit because you've been so immersed in this world of Lear that's got increasingly intense and dark and sinister and cruel. The play never actually lets you out of there until you step out of your seat and you go at the end of the play. So on, I suppose what I'm suggesting, and you might agree, on an intellectual level, you can kind of, that Christian reading of a hopeful ending kind of makes sense. Everybody who's taken out of their place or tries to get out of their place is put back again. The power is given back to good people at the end. King Lear is restored to Cordelia at the end. And the wheel has turned full circle, says Edgar, and the king's given back his kingdom, if only for a minute or two. And yet, that seems to be different from the emotional response that the play gets, which is one of real darkness, and someone said it was depressing. Well, it is, really, isn't it? Just have a look in your mind's eye over the stage and at the end, and at the people who are dead or dying or about to be. Someone definitely deserved it, didn't they? Do we mind if Goneril was lying there dead? No. Regan? No. Edmund? No. No? Although I quite like Edmund. His character's got a bit of get up and go about him, hasn't he? He went against a system that was stacked against him. And through pure brilliance and intelligence and a bit of manipulation, worked his way right up to the top. Said he would, and he did. Kind of, it's cruel. I mean, he part of blinding his father, that's a horrific thing to do, but he's a kind of villain you love to hate a bit, isn't he? I think.
You do sort of feel for him.
You feel for him at the end. And at the end, he tries to help, doesn't he? At the end, he says, look, I've done this. And it's a set of circumstances that leads them not to go and try and find Leon until it's too late. But we don't mind too much. We can rationalise the fact that Edmund's dead because he has done some horrible things. Okay, so those three we can say. What about Lear? Does Lear deserve to die at the end? Yes, no. I mean, he very deliberately went against the Great Chain of Being, Divine Right of Kings. Some of the curses he put on his daughters at the start were cruel, to say the least. Spiteful. Very, very quick to judge his daughter Cordelia. But does he deserve the end that he gets? It's a kind of open question, but no, perhaps. Because as well as himself dying, don't forget on the stage are his three daughters as well. This is a father who's looking at the utter desolation of his family. His family line is gone. His family is gone. So the ending is harsh, even if you can rationalise it. And then we come to Cordelia. Does she deserve to be dead on the stage? Oh, she done wrong. So I'll go back over the ending of the story in a minute. But Cordelia lies on the stage dead. And Kent says he's going to go off and kill himself, basically. Does he deserve that? Having served his king faithfully until the end. It's his choice. So in a sense he does deserve it because it's his choice. But does he deserve to be in that position where everything that he's worked for and hoped for he sees falling apart? He tried to restore the king and here he is. Here. So what we're saying is, whilst on one level, on an intellectual level, you can kind of rationalise it as a Christian play offering a warning but hope, on an emotional level, the play seems to draw a different response from us. Okay. Which is why, and we looked at the context of this when we started, which is why for hundreds of years, the original version of King Lear was not performed. The changed version, remember we talked about this? The changed version of King Lear was performed. And in the changed version of King Lear, the man's name who wrote the changed Lear, changed version, just gone for a minute, will come back to me shortly. In the changed version of King Lear lives, Cordelia lives, Cordelia marries Edgar. They become king and queen. Lear becomes there, is looked after by them. And they all live happily ever after. And now that makes a bit more sense, doesn't it? As a hopeful reading. Good people live, learn a lesson, they're restored. Cordelia gets a girl. No, Cordelia gets a man. That would be a different story. And all is well. But that's not the version of Shakespeare. Right, okay. So, let's look at this from a different point of view. Let's look at this then from a point of view of actually saying that this play questions the relationship between God and humanity and suggests that at best the gods are distant and cruel if they exist at all. That would be an alternative reading for this. That actually what Shakespeare is playing with, the idea that he's exploring and playing with is the idea that perhaps God isn't anything like we think he is. Perhaps actually he doesn't really care. And if he's there at all, he's very distant.
what evidence is there to support that? Well, one of the biggest bits of evidence to support that reading are all of the unanswered prayers in the play. We'll look through them when we turn to the text. But there are lots and lots and lots of unanswered prayers in the play. When, right at the start, Cordelia is banished by her father, Kent prays, kind of blesses her and asks God to look after her. Well, he does, to a point. France takes her away. But in the final analysis, God doesn't seem to have looked after Cordelia at all. Edgar prays when he thinks his father's out together, that his father would see the truth and that they'd be reconciled. Well, that prayer actually is answered. His father does eventually see the truth. They are eventually reconciled, but it doesn't do him much good. You know? And then one of the most ironic and cruelly unanswered prayers is as Gloucester sits tied to the chair and he says, as I will see winged vengeance overtake such children. And he prays for the gods to look after him and to bring bring justice on Cornwall and Bregan. And 30 seconds later, he's having his eyes plucked out. You won't see anything. Never mind winged vengeance. Gloucester's interesting because as soon as he said that, as soon as he had his eyes out, and he's out on the heath with Edgar, he says, "Are we as wanton boys to the gods?" As we as wandering boys to the gods, they kill us for their sport. We'll look at the quote. But in other words, Gloucester, after his blinding, believes actually that all the gods do is trick us, and they treat us as boys treat flies. You know, boys play with flies in a squash and they kill them and they all those sorts of things. We're like that to the gods, they kill us for their sport. And then we get, as I said, the final bit of the play where yes, those who've done evil are dead, but they lie alongside those who've done nothing but good. So where is God in the end of this play? Where is sense of justice and rightness? And critics who argue this way of reading the play would say, you can just about rationalise why these people have died, but you have to try very, very hard to do it. You have to say that Cordelia deserves it because she was disobedient to her father at the start. You have to say Kent deserved it because he was disobedient to his king. When the king asked him to be banished, he wasn't, he didn't leave, he stayed. So you can rationalise, you can say these people deserve to die because they didn't, they broke the great chain of being, the order, they didn't follow instructions. But it doesn't feel right, does it? Kent doesn't feel like he deserves to die, he's done nothing but try to help. Cordelia doesn't feel right that she does. So they would say you can rationalise it, but it doesn't feel right. So that leads us to that question, whose side are the gods on? What role do the gods play in this play? Any thoughts?
Must be some of the criticism then, of the Christian.
So, yeah. Go on, Steve.
There's no reward for the good characters.
Yeah.
Because they win the lives of like all the characters, they're cruel ones. So I have the best time,
yeah.
Like we can actually go.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no reward.
You know, when Albany and Edgar stand on the stage at the end, surrounded quite literally by dead bodies on the stage, and they say in very somber terms, "We've got to learn from this, and we've got to move forward and never forget what's happened here," which is effectively what they say. That isn't a sense of reward, is it? That's a sense of a real heavy duty on these poor men who are going to have to somehow rescue the kingdom from this kind of tragedy here. Yeah.
Could you say there's no actual like divine intervention from God?
Yeah.
All the deaths are man-made, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. All the deaths are man-made. And actually, at the times when divine intervention would have helped, for example, getting to the prison early enough to save Cordelia being hanged. You know, Edmund tells him, doesn't he, that I've sent them away and sent a note to get them hanged. And then there's interruption after interruption after interruption before they finally go and get them, by which point it's too late. You know, a bit of divine intervention there wouldn't have gone amiss, because that would have perhaps restored that. Or a bit of divine intervention when they got Gloucester tied to the chair, and he's helpless, and he prays, and where's the divine intervention there? What did Gloucester do to deserve that? Lauren, you were going to say.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't seem like God forgives. Like, if Lucky Mare at the beginning was cruel,
yes.
Discovered all his power, he did seem to learn his mistakes in the end.
Yes.
But he's still a lot of his children were killed and he died in the end anyway.
Yeah.
No matter, you know, he repented for his sins.
Right. That idea of where's the forgiveness here? Where's the sense of the things being put back the way they were or they should be? It's a really good question. And that's that very much in opposition to the idea of the morality play that we looked at. If you weren't in for that, I'll go over that another time. But morality play always ends with the everyman character being restored, forgiveness. And yes, he's done some terrible things, but he gets to spend eternity with God in heaven.
Did you say that the gods were because the good characters died?
Yeah.
It's like they're spending eternity then with God.
Right. So, yeah. So you can read into that. So, okay, the good characters died: Cordelia and Lear, Gloucester, Kent. But at least they get to spend eternity with God. Now, you can definitely argue that. My question would be: where's the evidence in the play to suggest that that's where they're going? Because there doesn't seem to be any discriminator in the play between those characters who have died because of their evil and those characters who have died despite their goodness. We can read into it, our Christian reading, and think, well, these characters have been good, therefore they'll go and spend eternity with God in heaven. But we have to do that reading, we have to read that into the play, don't we? The play never makes that distinction clear. A morality play would make it very clear which characters go and spend eternity in heaven and which spend it in hell. This play doesn't seem to deal with that. There's no sense of where these characters go after. Any other thoughts? Yes, Phil.
There's no punishment for the evil characters during the lifetime.
Good.
But there's no real
punishment. No, that's absolutely right. The punishment seems much more to fall on those characters who do good. And Cordelia spends most of the play exiled in France. And even when she comes back, she has the pain of seeing her father in his madness. She has that moment of reconciliation. But then, you know, the battle's lost and that's that. Well, where's her reward? And she seems much more punished than, for example, her sisters, who have lived the high life for most of the play. And even at the end, it's you know, they kill each other out of their jealousy about Edmund, but you know, there doesn't seem to be much punishment. That's a very good point. So I would say that from my reading of it, but it doesn't have to be your reading at all, that the for me, you have to work quite hard at the play to stick to a Christian reading of it. You can do it, you can argue it, and I've seen it argued very convincingly, but I think you have to work quite hard to do that. And I think not far under the surface of this play at all are some profound questions. So it might, on the surface, on an intellectual level, stick to an orthodox Christian reading, but you dig under the surface just a little bit, and for me it asks some really big questions about God and about our relationship as people with Him, about how much He intervenes in our lives, how much He is interested in our lives, which are much, much bigger questions than just King Lear, but it seems that it asks those questions. Okay, good. You've listened to me rabble on for a long time, so we'll have a 5 minute, it's half past 12.
5 minute break.